Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Depression. You know, so I guess that's the one form of mental illness that's kind of come out of the closet, right? We see antidepressants advertised on TV alongside new cars and Disneyland, you know, so it must be mainstreamed, and advertisers must know that a sizable percentage of Americans suffer to one extent or another from depression. My guest today is Therese Borchard, who has written a book called Beyond Blue about depression. She's an expert on depression and all its many aspects, and has actually suffered from it herself for much of her life. So she's kind of the go-to person often in professional blogs on depression, and she writes articles and published in different professional journals and pop science journals about psychology. But what I'm interested in is the difference between the kind of, I guess I'd call it garden variety depression, or really just the normal natural sadness that people experience in the course of life. You know, let's say your husband's left you, or you've lost your job and can't find another one, or your cat died, or for just a couple of days you just inexplicably feel blue, right? Feel sad. So those are normal emotions, I think. But then there's a deep, dark pit of despair that's a different form of that. And I don't know whether it's just an extreme, longer-lasting version of that normal sadness, or if it's an entirely different kind of phenomenon. And so that's what we're going to be talking with Therese about in part. Welcome, Therese.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on. So again, the title of Therese's book is, aptly enough, Beyond Blue, Surviving Depression and Anxiety and Making the Most of Bad Genes. That's the subtitle, and it's kind of funny, bad genes, but we will talk about the genetic aspect of it, whether it's partly an inherited condition. So let me just start off then by asking you, Therese, because as I said at the outset, you have struggled with really clinical depression for much of your life. Is there a continuum there between the normal blues and normal sadness and the deep and kind of, gripping illness of depression?
Yeah, I think sometimes it's difficult to decipher between the two. Some cases are very clear. You have symptoms of suicidal thoughts, and you can't function, and you can't sleep, you can't eat, you know, sort of all of the red flags of depression. But sometimes it's more subtle, and sometimes grief and sadness can become depression. You know, if the person just is there for more than 6 weeks, if it goes on 3 months, 4 months, it's not ending, then I think it can become depression. Your brain sort of starts forming those neural passages in such a way that it forms depression. So, but I think that psychiatrists really do need to spend some time with patients to determine what's the difference between the sadness and depression, and whether or not they should be treated with medication, or if yoga and meditation and healthy eating and exercise can do the job. Because I think that can, in many cases, if you're moderately or mildly depressed. And it's sometimes difficult to know when a person is severely depressed and needs to be medicated.
Well, from your own personal experience and from your research and from all of the people that you deal with in the blogs and the talks that you give and that kind of thing, are there signs, kind of, you know, indicators that make it clear that someone has a more serious case of it that you can tell almost with just a couple of questions? And maybe another way of putting that, is there kind of an accepted period of time or length of duration of feeling sad beyond which it's becoming more like a clinical situation? Is there some easy diagnostic indicators for those things?
I don't think there is an easy diagnostic, because I just think some people are much more sensitive than others. And so some people are going to cry for a whole year after their father dies, where some people, you know, grieve at the funeral and then get over it. Mm. But as a rule of thumb, I think they say between 6 weeks and 8 weeks, if you're not able to really pick up the pieces and move on. And another way of categorizing it is, if you're able to feel joy in parts of the day, if your sadness comes in waves, then it's usually grief. Whereas if you're just numb, if you can't feel anything and there's just this flattened sense of sadness, then it's depression. That you're able to really experience life and function even though you're experiencing sadness if you're grieving, but you're not really able to be awake to life if you are depressed.
Okay. So sadness is not, and grief are not, crippling.
They're not crippling. No. Yeah, I'd say that. I mean, for example, when I was very depressed, I couldn't stop crying. So it was very clear to my friends and family, because, you know, usually you have the ability to stop crying when you need to, like, appear in front of people. But I had no capability of stopping, and so it was very embarrassing.
Wow.
And also, you know, just the functioning, my driving was horrible. You know, I would lose control of the car and things like that. So, you know, those are all telltales. I think some other ones are the eating. You know, if eating is disrupted, if you're either eating way too much or not enough, your sleep, if you're, again, not sleeping or sleeping way too much, so if you're losing interest in your hobbies and in friends, if you're isolating, those are all, you know, symptoms, red flags, and, of course, suicidal ideations.
And again, if they go on for a long period of time, not just a day or two or three or four, I mean, you know, to some extent, even those kind of extreme things you were talking about can be normal.
I'd get worried after 6 weeks, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is it sometimes, you know, again, we see it on TV to the point that it's, you know, almost viewed as, you know, an antihistamine or something, the way the ads are presented. Is it sometimes overdiagnosed because it's maybe overnormalized in a sense, so that doctors in some cases will prescribe medication to somebody who really doesn't need it and wouldn't benefit from it? Do you think that happens?
I do think that happens, but some psychiatrists say that that people are undertreated, that the biggest problem is that people are not being treated correctly for their mood disorders. I think today, you know, most doctors who take insurance can only see you for about 10, 15 minutes. I don't think that's enough. That's way too short to be able to diagnose properly what a person is experiencing. So I think they're in a tough position because they have to fix this person in 10 minutes. And so I think they're going to prescribe a drug. They're going to want to tell them what the quickest route to recovery is, when I think the better is to really have a couple visits to go over the symptoms and the conditions in your past and, you know, where your thinking is. I just don't think that these are quick, you know, you can't diagnose it quickly.
Not a snap judgment kind of a thing. Yeah. I'm surprised at that, really, because I thought that the standard model for a psychiatrist would be a 50-minute or 1-hour session, but you're saying it's 10 or 15 minutes? That's kind of absurd. You're right.
Yeah, it's very quick. And unfortunately, I think the better doctors don't take insurance because they know that they can't diagnose. My doctor doesn't take anybody unless they are willing to come in for 2 hours at the first, you know, analyzing the situation. And so it's expensive, you know, it's very expensive. She doesn't take insurance, but I really respect her for needing that time, because she said it's just, I can't make a proper diagnosis without knowing absolutely their family history, everything that goes into consideration.
So it's kind of a catch-22. The doctors who are willing and able to do the job right are the doctors you can't afford to go to.
Yeah, it is a problem. It really is a problem. I went through 6 psychiatrists before I felt like Goldilocks, you know. And I can say that I found the right one for me, because she's very conservative with medication, and she likes when I do my own research instead of is threatened by it. She wants me to use all the other tools that I have, as far as the fish oil and the meditation and the yoga and all the other things that I do. Whereas I do think some psychiatrists sort of have a God complex. They want to, like, give you the magic potion and fix you. Where I really think it's a difficult job that the psychiatrist and the patient need to do together, and not just with medication. I mean, there needs to be a whole life change and transition and what you really need to do to get well.
You're listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Therese Borchard about depression. She's the author of a book called Beyond Blue, Surviving Depression and Anxiety and Making the Most of Bad Genes. And so we're talking kind of all about mental illness and the ways to approach it and diagnose it and treat it. But first, let's kind of put it in context. Depression is only one of a number of mental illnesses that have labels, right? Another one is schizophrenia, which I think involves hallucinations and so on. And another one is psychosis, which I'm not exactly sure what that is, but there are probably different forms of it. And paranoid delusions is one form, and it may involve hallucinations too. I don't know. But depression does not, right? So it's very distinct from those more, let's call it, you know, without minimizing it, let's call it more severe forms of mental illness. People who are depressed don't hear voices and see things, do they?
If you have bipolar disorder, you do. Sometimes if you have bipolar 1, you become delusional. Hmm. But just depression, major depression now.
So how common is depression today in our society, do you know?
I believe it's about 10%. It's about 1 out of 10. They say 1 out of every 4 people will generally suffer from a mood disorder at some point in their life. But I think the statistic for depression is around 1 in 10.
So when you say that, do you mean the clinical depression, the really severe kind that you're talking about that lasts for more than a number of weeks and is very hard to get over and requires medication and different forms of medical treatment to even have?
I think I read a study one time that said as many as like 75% of us have depression at one point of, you know, mild and moderate depression. So, yeah, I would say 1 out of 10 is the clinical depression, the one that needs to be really treated and monitored and so forth.
All right. So out of that 10%, and you're talking about at any given time then, right? At any given time, about 10% of the population has depression or?
I believe so.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people. That's like nearly 40 million people. My gosh. Out of that huge number of people, no wonder it's advertised on TV, right? Many more of them need that kind of help than will be buying a new car this year or going to Disney World. But maybe they need to do both or all three.
Right.
But anyway, so out of that large number of people, let's kind of look at the demographics of it. I'm sure that it varies from population group to group. Like, for example, off the top of my head, I would suppose that women may be more prone to depression than men. Is that true? And if so, what are the numbers? Do you know?
Yes, they are 2 or 3 times the rate of depression in men. And that's, I think, largely due to our menstrual cycles, all the hormonal effects of pregnancy, childbirth, you know, all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we're kind of, go up and down and up and down, and I can certainly appreciate that.
It's a roller coaster anyway.
And I feel bad for my husband.
If the roller coaster jumps off the rails every now and then, why not?
But they actually said that with the economy as it is right now, the men's depression is creeping up. I think Time just had a story on that because it's, you know, a lot of that, most of the women are still working and the men are losing their jobs because of the construction industry. And I know it's real in our house. My husband's an architect, and so I'm sort of the breadwinner. That is impacting men today because of the self-esteem. And, you know, that's very hard for a man when he loses his job.
Sure.
So, yeah, so it's creeping up. Now all we have to do is get them to have babies.
Wait a minute. I'm not going to go.
And then we'll be even.
I'm not going to go along with you on this plot here on the radio to feminize men further than they already are in this country. But anyway, so then I'm glad you can laugh. All right. So then maybe let's look racially then. Whites versus black people versus Hispanics.
You know, this was interesting. The statistics said that the African Americans are not any more depressed than whites, but I think that that's because a lot of them are very afraid to come forward. Their culture is such that, you know, you need to be strong, get through it, that they aren't as vocal about the depression or don't really see it as something that they need to treat. There was a study, though, in Israel that said that there was more depression in North Africa than Europe.
I thought you were going to say there was more depression among Palestinians than among Israelis. I was going to.
No, that would be interesting.
There's a great surprise.
Yeah, that would be an interesting news. It would. So, you know, I would think that the prejudice and the other, you know, things would go into more depression, but that hasn't been the statistics.
Okay. So, speculating, it may be also that whites are just more culturally open to the idea of going to a psychiatrist. I mean, probably 50 years ago, they were not, but I think maybe today they are, and, you know, for various reasons, but I'm just speculating, who knows. Well, how about another category of people if we're slicing and dicing and breaking down the population?
I found this interesting. According to a 2009 Gallup survey, Americans making less than $24,000 a year were more inclined to depression than annual incomes of above $60,000.
Okay.
So I guess that means all writers are depressed.
All artists. Everybody on the radio.
Yeah.
All right. So, but if you're a Wall Street investment banker and you're suddenly thrown out on your ear, even you can be depressed, I suppose. But
you can. And there was a good book, Saved by Starbucks, Starbucks Saved Me, about that that guy who was a Wall Street exec way up high, and then he lost his job, and so he worked at Starbucks behind the counter. Yeah, he wrote a book about it. What's interesting is that I read somewhere that said low achievers tend to be more depressed, but I found that that's interesting because you would think that they'd be kind of happy if they're not like, you know, wanting to go and be successful, that they'd be kind of happy in their situation.
Yeah, I don't know if I buy that offhand. It sounds kind of counterintuitive, like you say.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, let's put it bluntly, if you're lazy, you're not going to be depressed about not achieving high achievements in your career.
Yeah, I mean, you tend to think that lazy people are more content.
Yeah, right.
You know?
and then there are the blissfully ignorant. We can get into the education side.
We're gonna
step all over everybody here. But anyway.
I couldn't find the education, but that would be interesting to know too. What is interesting is when I looked at the urban versus rural, I thought that the urban would definitely be more depressed, but the rural actually is significantly higher.
Hmm.
And they said that that's probably because of poor health and
I see.
So forth.
And low income mixed with high ambition. So then how about young people versus elderly people? Do you know anything about that?
Middle-agers get hit the hardest.
Hmm.
And I think that's because with women, that's, you know, you're fertile and your hormones are going to be reckless then. And with men, I think they just have more stress. I read a story that said that, you know, the most stressful time is when you're raising the kids and when you're helping your parents.
Hmm.
You're saddled with both caretaking and child raising. And okay. I really think that's true. They said that before 13, there's, you know, now been more teen depression and so forth. But before 13, it's fairly uncommon for depression to really, you know, something to be concerned about. And then actually in older people, it's becoming more of a problem, especially for older people who don't have family around them and are just, you know, kind of stuck in these nursing homes.
Mm-hmm.
But that, as a rule, the older you get, the more away from depression. That it seems like doesn't necessarily mean that aging equals depression. You just get sick of other, you get sick from other stuff. So it takes a back burner.
You know? Your heart starts to concern you more than your head. But
yeah, you just worry about other things more.
All right. Well, we're laughing our way through a show on depression. And my guest is Therese Borchard. She's the author of Beyond Blue, Surviving Depression and Anxiety and Making the Most of Bad Genes. So the last part of your subtitle, Therese, kind of leads me to my next question. What causes depression? Is it more nature or nurture, or do we know?
Well, it's both. Definitely it's both. But I think that your genes prime you to respond to stress in certain ways. So, you know, there are genes that predispose you to bipolar and to OCD and schizophrenia and other of the, you know, the major mood disorders. And I think if you, the way I understand it is that if you have bad genes, and that's the way I categorize them, or genes that have predisposition to bipolar and depression.
Right.
And then you're put into a situation when you're young where you're totally stressed out, then that's just a recipe for depression. Because a lot of scientists have said the adrenal axis is also responsible. And sometimes if you're under stress as a kid, your brain actually produces more cortisol, stress hormone, than you need, and it can't stop producing that cortisol.
Mm.
So there is, you know, a physiological reason why you're more stressed out as you grow older. I think with me, I tend to be more sensitive probably than my sisters, and I think I was more probably predisposed to mental illness than some of them because I have more of the genes of my mom than my dad. So for me, that was sort of a recipe, whereas my sister, who maybe didn't have the same predisposition and is a little more resilient to all that stress that we were under as kids, does fine.
So you mentioned your mom. Did she have depression?
She was depressed. My dad and she split when I was about 11, and it was kind of a volatile divorce. And so she really plummeted into a depression for about 3 or 4 years when we were kids. And I don't fault her for that because, you know, as a mom, I got depressed, and I knew that that affected my kids. But I do think that there's been study after study that says that if the mom's depressed, it certainly impacts the kid.
Okay, but you're saying it didn't impact your sisters as much. So I'm getting the picture that if somebody has the genetic predisposition toward depression, then if they are subjected to emotional stress from whatever source at an early age, they're much more prone to become depressed as adults and maybe stay that way and have a harder time getting out of it because maybe they get rewired, essentially, is what you're saying, or their hormonal balance gets shifted in somewhat of a of an unhealthy way more permanently at an early age.
Yeah, huh? I think that's just it. I think some people are born more resilient than other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just kind of a truth. I think you can really train yourself to be more resilient, and I think I'm doing a pretty good job of that right now. But it's an uphill battle, I think, for someone who has both predisposed to the illness and coming from a background where that stress was early on.
You mentioned that you were more sensitive than your sisters, and so is emotional sensitivity, which is not necessarily, I wouldn't think, the same as a predisposition toward mental illness, but is somebody who's just very, very sensitive emotionally and is perceptive and can pick up nuances of what other people are feeling and that kind of thing. Is that kind of person inherently much more prone to depression than others?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I love the book, The Highly Sensitive Person by Elaine Aron, and it's been really, really helpful for me in my recovery. And I talk about it a lot on my blog, and almost everybody who writes back says, oh my God, that's me. So I do think, yes, I think, you know, she talks about how you see things. Somebody might see two oranges, but the highly sensitive person sees 15 oranges in different colors. And so the period of processing that information is just much more strenuous for the person who's sensitive than the other person, and that's a big job, and that translates sometimes into depression.
You know, you're describing really what could be called the artistic temperament, right? Somebody who's just very alert to their environment and sees slight distinctions and changes and sees things more acutely than other people are aware of their surroundings and what's going on both emotionally and in the material world around them, right? So
yeah, Kay Redfield Jameson talks about the artistic person and the creativity and the sort of the manic depressive quality of that, and I love her work for that reason, because it gives the condition a certain redemptive cause. But I also love Peter Kramer, because he's always talking about being wary of the melancholy, the heroic melancholy, that we say depression is great because it causes you to do all these fun things. And he got sick of people saying that Van Gogh wouldn't have painted his masterpieces had someone given him Prozac.
Yeah.
And he writes about this in Against Depression. He says that, you know, no one would say that of tuberculosis or of these other illnesses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that Van Gogh would have painted an even better masterpiece, you know, had he had Prozac. So I can kind of see both sides. I definitely do think that the depression, certainly with me, has made my writing realer and more alive and colorful. And yet I can also see Kramer's point of view that, wait a minute, we're talking about an illness and a disease, not a temperament.
Well, if you're an artist, I guess it cuts both ways. I suspect that it does heighten your sensitivity, or your sensitivity is already heightened. The same thing that makes you prone to depression or manic depressiveness will also make you inclined to be a better artist. I mean, even somebody like Hemingway, who is viewed as kind of the icon of manliness, you know, with all the boxing and the bullfighting and the womanizing and everything else, shot himself at the age of 61. And he called it the black dog. And he would just basically go in his room and in his part of the house and lock the door and not come out for 3 days. He would get so severely depressed,
mm-hmm.
a time long before there was any medication other than alcohol for it.
Mm-hmm.
And he would get, you know, into these benders. And I suspect that that explains a lot of people who go on alcoholic binges. But Hemingway's father was a doctor in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan back in the late 1800s. He killed himself. People don't really realize that. So, you know, somebody as manly as that, who's the kind of epitome of manliness, it has nothing to do with being weak, right? And
right.
And so,
you look at,
but he's an artist.
Abraham Lincoln, and
yeah.
One of the scholars is Joshua Shank. He's a friend of mine, and he wrote Lincoln's Melancholy, and it's just a fascinating book into the psyche of Lincoln and how he really transformed his depression into being liberating for the country. I mean, but he was suicidal for 2 years. His friends didn't trust him to be alone, and so they like hid him in a cottage for 2 years because they knew he was so depressed that that if he could, he would end his life. And so that book really inspired me, because, you know, there's periods where I think, oh God, what if this medication poops out and you know, have no help? And I looked to Lincoln and I thought, well, he, you know, not that he had a choice, but he did do it himself. And so he had to, you know, really try and be resilient.
I think we're talking about, you know, all of the people before 50 years ago or whatever, who throughout human history suffered with this, along with tooth decay and all kinds of things that they couldn't treat, and yet achieved great things, did what they did, lived their lives, and were heroic, right? So ask you another quick question here. Is it more prevalent among Catholics? I kind of have that impression, which is sort of a politically incorrect thing to ask you, but you're Catholic, and I think you actually mentioned that in your book.
Well, I don't know if it's more prevalent among Catholics, but I do say that Catholicism is the best religion for the mentally ill.
I don't mean a genetic thing that runs through the Catholic groups, but I think maybe the idea of an early age being instilled with guilt and the consciousness of sin.
The guilt is huge, yeah.
And it kind of adds
to Jewish, too.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, because it is a river that feeds into depression. Mm. Absolutely, guilt is. And I think sometimes with Catholic, it's hard to discern between scrupulosity and a mood disorder. I think when I was young, I wasn't saying the rosary 100 times because I was holy. I was saying it because I was OCD.
There you go. It made it easy.
So, yeah, it's religion plays an interesting role with depression. They say that people who are depressed are more prone to get help from their religion. On the other side, more people who are religious are depressed.
Hmm, okay.
But they find redemption and help in their religion.
But not necessarily a cure.
No, but I think, you know, like in my life, it was really my faith ultimately that kept me alive, because I knew that there was a higher purpose, or that God, I knew that I couldn't end my life because it wasn't really mine for the taking.
And you had children, so.
Yes.
Therese, we just have a minute or so left, and gosh, I'd like to talk with you longer about this, but I guess a question to ask you is, how effective is the medical system in general for treating depression? I mean, between the drugs and the talking therapy and institutionalization and all of that, is it pretty much barely helpful, or is it pretty effective, or what?
Well, I was just reading literature from Johns Hopkins that said 80% of people do get better. And I think I had read DiPaolo's, he's the director of the Mood Disorder Clinic. I think he said, I can get 80% of people well 80% of the time.
Hmm.
And that's good news. That's very good news. But it takes hard work, and it takes a person to stay on the medication. And that's probably the biggest problem that doctors face, is that people feel better and they want to go off, especially when they have mood disorders like bipolar. So there's a lot of legwork that you have to do as the patient. I mean, the doctor can help you to a certain extent, but it's your illness that you have to take care of.
So like a lot of things in life, it takes work. There's no easy answer, no easy cure.
No.
And it may be like alcoholism, maybe it's a lifelong thing that you basically have to learn to manage. Would you say that's...
Yeah, I think it's very like that. As a person who has 22 years of sobriety, it's a lot like that.
Well, Therese Borchard, thank you so much for being on with us and talking with us about depression. Her last name is B-O-R-C-H-A-R-D. The book is Beyond Blue, and I won't read the long subtitle, but Beyond Blue, Therese Borchard. And she has a website, therese borchard.com. Now that's Therese with an E on the end instead of an A, therese borchard.com. Thanks again for being on with us, Therese.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to you all for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.